You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Few writers create the kind of excitement that Taye Selassie has generated with her first novel, Ghana Must Go. Ms. Selassie came to the attention of the literary world 2 years ago after her story, The Sex Lives of African Girls, was published in Granta and then selected for inclusion in the Best American Short Stories. Her novel, about a family that's dispersed around the world but maintains its roots in Africa, has already been translated into 15 languages and won praise from the likes of Toni Morrison and Salman Rushdie. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Taye Selassie to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Although you have resisted other people's efforts to label you or put you in a box, you've characterized yourself as Afropolitan. What does it mean to be Afropolitan?
Yes, I resist everyone's efforts to put me in a box except for my own.
Well, what kind of box are they trying to put you in?
Oh, my goodness. What kind of box are they not trying to put me in? So there's the African writer, a term which always makes me chuckle softly to myself. There's the sort of brown lady writer. The company there is fantastic, I should say, and so on and so on and so forth.
African diaspora.
African writer. Diaspora, exactly. Afropolitan.
So you came up with that term?
It's funny. I'm certain that I must have heard that term somewhere, but what I did in 2005 was I wrote that essay, Bye Bye Babar, or What is an Afropolitan, sort of imagining an identity, which at the time I called new, but upon reflection I can see that there have always been Afropolitans. I just didn't recognize that.
And many scattered around the world?
And many scattered around the world. With the tragic death of Achebe, I had occasion to reflect upon the extent to which he was Afropolitan. Because as I conceive of it, an Afropolitan is simply someone who, one, has an unbreakable bond to a country or countries on the African continent, two, a decidedly humanist or global perspective, and three, some deep commitment expressed, however it may, to changing the way Africa and Africans have been treated and perceived in the world.
You were born in London, grew up in Massachusetts, now live in Rome, but I haven't heard Africa there. Like the characters in your novel, your mother is Nigerian, your father is Ghanaian. Your father was a highly regarded surgeon who left your family when you were a child. Do you get tired of being asked about how much this novel is autobiographical?
I brought it on myself by putting so many autobiographical details into the book. And so no. I say this and I mean it. By using details, superficial details, the names of streets, buildings, colleges, and so forth that were familiar to me, I freed myself to pay more attention and give more energy to the interior lives of these characters. And so Kwaku is a surgeon like my dad, Fola is Nigerian and Scottish like my mom, Olu goes to Harvard Med like my twin, Sadie goes to Yale like the two of us, etc. And that's simply perhaps because I was a bit less interested in those details than I was in the emotional ones.
And you're a twin, and there are twins in this novel.
Absolutely.
Are you fraternal twins?
My twin sister and I are fraternal, as are the boy-girl twins in the novel. But I would put the twin business in a different category than the superficial details.
Your novel tells a story of the Sai family. It begins with the death of its patriarch, Kwaku Sai, from a heart attack when he's just 53 years old. Mm. But the structure is quite complex. It moves back and forth in time. Why did you decide to tell the story that way instead of just doing a more linear narrative?
I think the story decided to tell itself that way to me. I started writing Ghana Must Go after a bit of a moment of revelation, if you will, and I went straight through to the end of part one, which is 100 pages long. I had the entire vision for the story already in mind, and then when I found my wonderful agent Andrew, I ended up outlining that story, but I didn't make particularly conscious decisions about how to tell the story. I literally, like Philip Glass says, I don't write music, I just write it down. I just wrote the story down the way I received it.
You say it sprang into your mind almost fully formed. You didn't mention it was 5 a.m. and you were in a yoga retreat in Sweden.
Indeed, in October, therefore freezing.
But had you already been thinking about writing a novel?
I'd been thinking about writing a novel for 20 years.
So what did you do? Did you leave the retreat early because you had to go somewhere and start
we
writing
fled.
The novel?
My dear friend Kirstie Samuels and I, we took to the road because the yoga retreat, as many do, forbade the use of electronics. And I was not having much luck sort of scrawling it out on napkin and stubbed out pencil. So we went to Copenhagen, checked into a hotel. She was finishing her book and I began mine.
And is that the way it generally starts for you, all in a flash?
Always, always. The story is always one day there. But I'll say I can never begin a story until I hear a first line. And it was when I heard the first line of this novel that I knew I was ready to begin writing it.
You're going to read for us. Are you going to read the first line?
I will, if you like. Like to hear it? Here it goes. Kweku dies barefoot on a Sunday before sunrise, his slippers by the doorway to the bedroom, like dogs. At the moment, he is on the threshold between sunroom and garden, considering whether to go back to get them. He won't. His second wife, Amma, is asleep in that bedroom, her lips parted loosely, her brow lightly furrowed, her cheek hotly seeking some cool patch of pillow, and he doesn't want to wake her. He couldn't if he tried. She sleeps like a kokoyam, a thing without senses. She sleeps like his mother, unplugged from the world. Their house could be robbed by Nigerians in flip-flops rolling right up to their door in rusting Russian army tanks, eschewing subtlety entirely as they've taken to doing on Victoria Island, or so he hears from his friends, the crude oil kings and cowboys demobbed to Greater Lagos, that odd breed of African, fearless and rich. And she'd go on snoring sweetly, a kind of musical arrangement, dreaming sugar plums and Tchaikovsky. She sleeps like a child. But he's carried the thought anyway, from bedroom to sunroom, making a production of being careful, a show for himself. He does this, has always done this, since leaving the little open-air performances for an audience of one, or for two. Him and his cameraman, that silent, invisible cameraman who stole away beside him all those decades ago, in the darkness before daybreak with the ocean beside, and who has followed him every day, everywhere since, quietly filming his life, or the life of the man who he wishes to be and who he left to become.
So you say that that opening line triggered everything that followed there? Did the whole paragraph just flow?
Those first 10 pages came out in a single sitting, in a rush. And from there, I plodded on through the next.
And you traveled around to a whole bunch of different places while you were writing the book. Were you doing research, or was it just where your life was taking you?
No, actually, I was rereading this wonderful interview in the Paris Review with James Baldwin. An interviewer asks him, "How did you come to leave the United States?" And he says, "I was broke." That's definitely my story, too. I'd quit my job. My savings were flowing freely in the direction of my student loans, and I had to leave New York City.
I've heard that you suffered from terrible writer's block soon after you started the novel. Do you have any idea why you had the block?
I was afraid. I had submitted the first 100 pages to an agent who then sold them to the editor of my dreams. I had nothing to do now but finish the novel, and suddenly I was frightened that I wasn't good enough. And every word that I wrote, I held to this standard of perfection, which, of course, no piece of fiction ever meets. And it took me all that time, with a heartbreak thrown in, to find my way back to my voice.
And you've said that you feel writer's block, whenever you feel writer's block coming on, when you're in your apartment in Rome, you just go look at one of Caravaggio's paintings in a church that's nearby.
I sure do. First of all, the walk from my apartment to that church is lined with beautiful things, beautiful sky, beautiful buildings, beautiful people, beautiful cornetti. And then when I get there, to just look at the way Caravaggio uses paint, I say using dark upon dark upon dark to create dark, it's very similar to what I like to think of as my writing style, which is layered and dense and intense.
Now, we should just give a little idea of what the plot is here.
Let's.
Kweku's wife, Fola, has turned down a chance to attend law school to raise her four children, and the family struggles financially after Kweku, who is a brilliant surgeon, is fired from his job at a Boston hospital. Why was he fired?
I don't want to give too much away.
Won't give too much away.
Okay, he's fired perhaps unjustly when a patient he's operated on passes away.
Does he feel that he's something of a convenient scapegoat because he's an African?
I think he feels that way. But more than that, I think he feels that he can't stand up to the greater machine that he's up against, the hospital, the Harvard Industrial Medical Complex, as my mom used to jokingly call it.
And then he has to spend much of their savings to defend his name.
That's right.
And then he winds up just leaving.
Indeed, because
abandoning the family.
I think about that moment in Kwaku's life, he throws everything into this countersuit, thinking that he'll win, and thinking that once he wins, he'll get all the money back, and he can either tell his family or just move on. And this, of course, is in the time before the internet, when things could have still been kept quiet and private, and it doesn't happen that way.
And there are four children.
There are.
Including a pair of twins.
Indeed.
And a lot of the story, we don't find out a lot of what goes on between, in their various stories until pretty much the end.
Right.
You're withholding, including a story that I'm not going to be a spoiler here, okay. But that's rather shocking.
Well, I think so. And this is another thing that I thought about. Because as I said, I wrote the story the way I received the story. I didn't make very many conscious decisions about how to tell it at all. And when it was done, I thought to myself, have I left it too late? This revelation, if you will, about what happens to the twins. But in a way, I like it where it is, because in the same way that the reader doesn't know what's happened to the twins, neither does their mother. And that weight of not knowing it doesn't operate as a sort of plot device, but it really does speak to this huge burden that is sitting on their mother's heart.
Now, the twins kind of can communicate without talking.
That's right.
Is that an injection of magical realism into this book?
Absolutely not. My sister and I can communicate without talking.
Well, what does that mean? You just look at each other and you know what you're thinking?
Well, A, and B, when we're not even together, we can sense each other. I was about to do an interview in London, I remember, and I woke up at about 8 a.m. in London, so very early in the morning in Baltimore, where my sister's finishing her residency. And
Johns Hopkins.
I was just overwhelmed with this sense of panic. And so I thought I'd call her, but I didn't want to wake her. And so I sent her a message. She wrote back right away, and she said, yeah, I just woke up from a nightmare. And I mean, literally, Leonard, it was as if I was experiencing her panic. And we joke. I said, well, great. Can you take your panic back? Because I have to do an interview in like 25 minutes. And we just laughed. But I mean, sometimes she cries my tears. It goes back and forth.
I'm curious about a detail you've included in this novel. When Kwaku's family returns to Ghana to bury him, they see coffins made by the coffin maker in shapes that represent the lives of the people who'll be buried in them. A fisherman might have a fish-shaped coffin, or a gardener would be in a coffin that's shaped like a flower.
Right.
Do coffin makers in Ghana really make coffins like these, or is that something you've invented?
Absolutely not. I wish. The Ga people of coastal Ghana indeed have this tradition. It's called fantasy coffins, and it's a huge industry. You can get quite rich making coffins in Ghana because, as said, when someone dies, the coffin is meant to reflect their life. So if I were Ga, which I'm not, my father is Ewe, I still might love to be buried in a coffin shaped like a pencil, for example.
I'd have to be buried in a radio.
Exactly, like an old school boombox. Exactly, that's the idea. And Kainde, the artist of the family, decides that he's going to do a gallery show in New York of these coffins.
Because right now, art has become international, as we've seen, where a great Ghanaian artist now lives in Nigeria, is perhaps the most famous artist from Africa. Had a major show at the Brooklyn Museum.
Just as well, it should be.
Where does this title come from, Ghana Must Go?
In 1983, the Nigerian government, famous throughout the land for its level-headed policymaking, decided to evict 2 million Ghanaians, giving them 24 hours to leave the country. In their haste, the Ghanaians threw most of their worldly possessions into these massive plaid plastic bags imported from China, which you've seen if you've been to any international port. And as they left, the Nigerians were taunting things like Ghana go home or Ghana must go. In this way, those bags came to be known as Ghana Must Go bags. But now, we Ghanaians, we still call them Ghana Must Go bags, but having denuded the phrase of any negative connotation.
Have the two countries patched up their relations?
Well, to the extent that now in Ghana we're saying Nigeria must go, I don't know. But certainly in my family, we have.
Ghana Must Go is Taye Selassie's novel, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
My absolute pleasure.